Bonjour, vous écoutez Noir Atlantique, un podcast de Fania Noël produit par Kizu Studio. Dans Noir Atlantique, je suis en conversation.
Hello, you are listening to Noir Atlantic, a podcast by Fania Noël produced by Kizu Studio. In Noir Atlantic, I speak with Black activists, artists, academics, and intellectuals, and we talk about our experiences, as well as Black struggles, cultures, and thinking. It's fall, so many of us are taking our school bags to head back to school, whether it's the small school or the big one. To kick things off, today's program is about guerrilla intellectualism, or as I often like to say, doing a PhD is not activism. Indeed, exceptionalism is not in and of itself a political project, nor is diversifying prestigious institutions, because we still need a political compass. In this episode, our compass will be that of Guyanese activist, historian, and politician Walter Rodney. It's a compass that always shows the direction of the revolution, and we will be discussing one of his key concepts, guerrilla intellectualism. For Walter Rodney, the mission of guerrilla intellectualism is to redistribute and subvert the academic monopoly surrounding the legitimate production and distribution of knowledge by bringing it out of the ivory tower to be critiqued, challenged, and used to further Black political liberation projects. I am pleased and honored to have Rebecca as my guest for this discussion today. Rebecca A. Wilcox is a PhD student at Princeton Theological Seminary, concentrating in religion and society. Her research uses analytics of spectral theory, anti-Blackness, and Black feminism to explore the hauntings of Black radical epistemologies honed out of underground economies. Wilcox is from the Bronx, New York, where she was raised by her mother and five siblings. She is also a proud HBCU alumna of Clark Atlanta University. Hello and welcome, Rebecca. How are you?
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for having me. I want to name my limitations now. I am no scholar of Walter Rodney at all, but I'm familiar with the context. I'm familiar with the body of work of how Europe underdeveloped Africa. So I hope that I can be helpful to the conversation in some capacity.
Personally, I'm really happy because you're part of my Twitter top five. So I'm just really excited to have you here today.
Donc voilà, je voulais savoir. Alors,
I wanted to know. So we're both PhD students at predominantly white institutions. And in an academic context, where being a scholarly activist is the thing, I'm at the New School, where that's literally the university slogan, this whole idea of scholarly activist. In short, how do you see this double posture of both situating or saying that activism within the university, while at the same time designating activist work as completely separate from theoretical and intellectual production?
Well, I don't know that activists, I use that term loosely because it's been so appropriated and co-opted today that I don't even think it has utility anymore. But I don't think that theory is directly, or, you know, intellectual property or rigor or knowledge production itself, right, is in conflict with activism or, you know, some type of political insurgency that, you know, we might look to engage. However, I do agree that there's something happening within the liberal academy around this scholar activist kind of, you know, status quo. And it's almost as if we don't really know what that means anymore. Like, we don't really know what the function of that is. What we do know, though, it's not the guerrilla intellectualism that Walter Rodney, you know, kind of pushes forward in his own radical insurgency. But I guess for me, I am very intentional about not naming myself as an activist because I am in the academy full time, right? And I also know that the work that I do is a form of knowledge production that seeks to inform not necessarily social movements, but my own relationship to the world, mm-hmm. right? So I don't know that I do my work for anyone else because I am not up for consumption. Right. And I think that that's a different posture, is that I know that the work that is being produced through the academy is up for consumption. Right. It is, that is what we do. We produce for the consumption of the academy. And because the body of work, the intellectual property that we produce, no matter how radical it might be or how radical the theoretical frameworks are, they are always for the substantiation of the academy. Right. And so I think then we have to like kind of layer what we mean by the academy, because you have, it's really important for me to put in my bio that I went to Parkland University, not because I think HBCUs are a freedom path at all. I do not think that they are definitely an extension of the state, but it's because I think that there are levels to this academic shit, right? Like there is you have community colleges, you have junior colleges, you have all different, within the academy, you have all different sectors of knowledge production. And then by the time you get to like universities such as ours or seminaries.
Ce point est assez important parce que justement.
That's a really important point. Because like you said, when people try to paint the academic sphere as being homogenous, it's as if saying Harvard was the same thing as a community college. As if these elite university stars occupied the same position as temporary workers, those who allow the academic system to function, but who don't have tenured positions. People try to put them all in the same bag, yet some academics have their housing paid for, while others are just trying to get by with precarious job positions. That's just my little tangent. As a doctoral student who's always running around looking for funding to attend conferences.
No, I mean, that's a really important intervention because recently what we saw was like when 1619 Project, I can't think of her name right now, but when she didn't get tenured and there was like this uproar from the Liberal Academy about, oh my God, how could you not tenure her? She's like the greatest person ever, when the 1619 Project was a liberal project, right? And then you have non-tenured professors at Howard putting out public letters saying, actually, just because you're coming to Howard and now they're going to give you tenure because you're like the celebrity status and that is what, you know, Howard benefits off of, doesn't mean that Howard treats Black professors the way that they need to be treated, right? So what they deserve, it doesn't mean that they're not being appropriated through wage labor. It's like, that's not actually the case, right? And so there's levels to this. And I think, as I was stating, when you get to universities such as, in seminaries such as ours that, you know, have billion-dollar endowments and things of that nature, you see that these professors or these scholars have a monopoly on discourse. Right. And so if there is a radical insurgency happening, it's not coming from, you know, we would say the top, it's not coming from the Ivies, although there are brilliant, amazing radical formations happening from professors such as like, you know, Dr. Joy James, who goes to Williams College, and that is a prestigious institution. But also because her project is so committed to some type of radical formation, you don't see Joy James on the syllabus. Like you won't see her on a common syllabus in the academy. You won't see her work being taught as an intervention to knowledge production. I mean, she is literally a political theorist, and I mean, they would rather teach Foucault and she intervenes Foucault, right?
Non, so, c'est vraiment important parce que au pessimisme, c'est le nouveau truc qui n'est pas important.
Yeah, that's so true. Because Afro-pessimism is like the new in thing right now that it's treated as not important, but it's so unimportant that they spend time saying that it's unimportant. At a certain point, you have to choose. And to build on what you were saying, since I was and still am an activist before entering academia, I have really been struggling with something that in a way is just me not accepting reality. about how within the academic world, lots of activities are labeled as activism in the same way that a lot of activities are characterized as critical race theory, as if anything and everything can be characterized as critical race theory. So you have all these activities that are framed as forms of activism in a way that's somewhat valid, but also somewhat just hype. When in reality, aside from the work done in university unions to improve working conditions of the intellectual proletariat, I have a really hard time seeing what this scholarly activism actually is. I don't understand what it is or where it would be found. Are you able to identify or observe this so-called scholarly activism? Or if we go even further, what could be called guerrilla intellectualism within academia, whether that be in community colleges or the Ivies or institutions that claim to have a monopoly over legitimate knowledge?
Yeah, so activism is not going to come from academia. Like, let me say this. Some type of insurgency or insurrection, which is the only type of activism I'm concerned with, that's not going to come from academia. And I think that if you are going to see it, it's always going to come from the students. It's always going to come from student organizers who are challenging the actual departments, the funding, the president's administration. Like, it's always going to come from the body of students. As far as a body of work, mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's interesting that you bring up Afro-pessimism because, you know, Afro-pessimism came in and, like, told everyone, you know, you don't have a job. It's like you, all of your theories are, like, insufficient because you need a more...
Je pense que t'as un rêve énorme, actually, no.
So, right. So they just came and shut everything down. And what I've seen, because I don't want to be, like, Afro-pessimism is radical, right? Because I don't think that, not because I don't think that it offers us political language, right? But because I don't think that its aim is to radicalize more so than I think its aim is to give us a grammar of suffering, right? Which is very different than a process of radicalization. I don't think Afro-pessimism is, as a discourse, is pushing to organize the academy, right? And I want to be very clear on like its intentions. However, because of its analysis that it offers, right? Because of the analytic that it offers us, I do think that what we see happening in academia is a organized destabilization of the discourse. I mean, you have departments telling graduate students to change their thinkers and their methodology if they're thinking with Afro-pessimism, because, you know, it's like, which is interesting because we're talking about the liberal academy right now. You also brought up Marxism. And it people assume that Afro-pessimists are talking to liberals, and they're not. Like, we already have reached a consensus by way of Marxist and the Black radical tradition that liberals are insufficient and liberals stabilize the state. So we don't have to do that work. Marxists and feminists already did that work. But then we have to turn to the radical political insurgency, which is considered to be the Black radical tradition, the Marxist tradition, and the Black feminist tradition. And those are the people that Afro-pessimists are talking to as it relates to their analysis of oppression, colonialism, and slavery, and how it has insufficiently, you know, provided an analytic of slavery for the sake of political economy and political economy, gender, intersectionality, critical race theory, for the things that you have offered, right? So even the best of intellectualism, which would for me be Walter Rodney's, and, you know, everyone refers to Cedric Robinson's Black Marxism, like the best of the body of literature that we have regarding some type of radical insurgency, still in some way is concerned with the substantiation of the nation state, right? It's still concerned with African sovereignty. And so you have a discourse like Afro-pessimism saying, actually, y'all, sovereignty might be the problem, right? Nation states might be the problem, right?
Yeah.
We can't actually like organize around African sovereignty when at the end of the day, like we are finding that sovereignty needs a slave, right? And even for Africans, right? Even for this category of what it means to be African, it's predicated upon a sovereignty that is parasitic upon Blackness, right? And so that type of truth telling, I would say, is rare in academic discourse, which is what initially attracted me to the discourse. But it is also the thing that is constantly weaponized in the academy, that constantly proves that the academy is not a place for radical insurgency, nor is the academy a place for truth telling. The academy is a place of hegemony. And if the discourse of hegemony is to say that, you know, the goal is liberation and freedom under the guise of this criteria, which is like, you know, keep America intact, reform America, like those type of things. Like the discourse of the academy is for the reformation, the reform of nation states, or for the reform of hegemony, or for the reform of prisons. So that way we don't have to like create some type of insurrection against these institutions of power and these ideologies of power if the academy cannot engage, let me say this simply, if the academy cannot engage in ideological warfare, then the academy is fundamentally committed to the destabilization of radicalisms. And I think that's really it, right? Like, and Joy James has a quote when she says, when you are doing ideological warfare, right? Like when you are trying to galvanize the people around in a type of political insurgency that is not just predicated upon, you know, the hegemony that is wielded by the academy or this type of intellectualism, you find yourself being disciplined, but not debated. Like they won't engage you critically, but they'll discipline you. And that's what happens when you see some type of radical insurgency happening in the academy. You see a host of scholars coming for an individual discourse to destabilize it, because that discourse fundamentally intervenes the very categories that other people's bodies of work might be engaging in. And I think, so I guess I will say that I don't think that you're going to get radicalisms in the academy, because the liberal hegemony of the academy is fundamentally committed to destabilizing radicalisms. And I think that the students are the ones that intervene how these radicalisms, this is how graduate students are taking on Afro-pessimism, right? And doing a host of different things with it. But I also think that the best of the literature that we have that is considered academic literature within the Black radical tradition and within Afro-pessimist discourse is fundamentally destabilized by academics.
The concept of Black-Brown relations having derived from the initial Black-White controversy is one of the lines of analysis. The second is that class struggle was indeed the principal motive force of Guyanese as of Caribbean history, but at the same time, that racism is responsible for important intra-class conflict, which is a topic that perhaps both historically and abstractly is not dealt with sufficiently. Intra-class conflict within different classes, within different strata, were in fact based on a real or imagined conflict of races. And thirdly, one of the consequences of assessing our history in Guyana is to come to the conclusion that at any given stage, the existence of racism as an aspect of consciousness, as an aspect of ideology, and the existence of racism as a facet in the structure of production relations is always guaranteed and promoted by a class outside of the working class. That the genesis and the determination of racism in the society is to be located outside of the working people themselves. And these are points that I would hope to elaborate on, and in the process to bring you up to date with a sort of race class structure that has emerged in our particular part of the world. So,
ça fait beaucoup de sens. Donc, en fait, si on essaye de bien comprendre ce que tu dis,
that makes a lot of sense. So if we try to really understand what you're saying, in terms of the horizon of guerrilla intellectualism within academia, It's not the university that's going to be at the vanguard of the insurrection or a revolutionary force. But how, in your opinion, can we engage in decarcerating work, as in extracting or liberating the knowledges and resources that are confined within these liberal academic institutions to push them outside while having, in the sense of scholarly activism, one foot within the sphere of institutional academia and the other foot in our communities, political movements, etc. So how can we move towards this work of decarceration, because we can hope that after the revolution, including the revolution against the symbolic order, that the university will also be obsolete. But in the meantime, what can we do?
So I think this is a really interesting question, because at the heart of the question, correct me if I'm wrong, it still sounds as if there is a commitment to revolutionizing or mobilizing and organizing.
Yeah, en fait, je sais pas si il y a. En fait, c'est ça. En fait, c'est ça. Le, je pense que le présupposé, c'est que...
Yes, I think you're right. I think the assumption is that for those who have this conviction and this attachment to the idea that we don't just go into academia to stay within academia and think that they can be the vanguard of the revolution, for this small minority who ask themselves, what can we do to make it a reality and not just get caught up in all the internal battles of faculty meetings and the internal affairs of the university? What can we do so that the conversation does not center on the fight for positions that can be held within the universities on the tenure track, but rather something that collectively advances Black liberation and issues, movements, and struggles that are everyday and tangible?
So I want to start with saying, reiterating what I named earlier, which is that you have to fundamentally understand your position in the university as being up for consumption, right? So you will produce whatever the institution that pays you tells you to produce, right? When you are being paid, when you are a worker, there are a set of conditions by which you must adhere to in order for you to get paid and for you to sustain yourself, but also for you to be committed to that institution. So if you're going to make a choice to be committed to the institution, then you have already opted out of political insurgency. I'm clear about that.
These people within academia who think that they're not workers within relations of class and production,
the very relation would be that of production, right? So with that being said, if we put that on the table, then I will say that because of my political commitments, which would be what you're talking about, some type of insurgency, right? I understand fundamentally my position in the academy as a thief, right? And fundamentally committed to extracting the resources here. So whatever resources I get here, whether so it's if you are in politically organizing spaces and you do political education, you know that the access to the archives that we have access to is not archives that, you know, is just up there. So, I mean, mm-hmm. I'm fundamentally committed to taking the PDF files and taking, you know, the resources that the Academy allows us to have. I mean, like if we... It's a lot of stuff that I can't tell on y'all on this, what I actually do here. But I'm just saying all of that to say that, like, your position, your relationship to the academy has to be one of extraction, because, I mean, they are going to suck. It's parasitic, right? So it's going to suck everything out of you for its own consumption. And therefore, if you're going to be here and allow yourself to be the host of that parasitic relationship, not saying that it's consensual, right? I'm not saying that this is something like I sign up for this. It's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying this is the modality. These are the terms of this is the terms of agreement, right? If that's the case, then I think that a lot of academics need to position themselves as people who extract resources from the academy. Sometimes that does look like a type of rebellion or Sometimes that looks like a type of disrespect to the code of conduct, right? Sometimes that looks like sharing your password with the general public to access certain files or certain things, or, you know, whatever the case is. But I also think that the other part of that is, like, you're only here to produce, right? Like, my time is not, I'm very serious about this, that being at Princeton Seminary, I don't linger, I don't go to events, I don't go to gatherings.
Yeah, tu vois, c'est pour ça.
That's why, that's the problem. Then they say that we're antisocial because they see on Instagram that we're living our own lives, but you never come to events. That's the problem. That's what they criticize us for.
Yeah, no, maybe I am antisocial.
No new friend.
That, but what I care more so about is that I'm always in it and against it, right? So there's no round table that you can feel comfortable enough to invite me to that is not going to have some type of, like, political currency for my cause of war, right? So I'm never sitting at the table trying to, like, figure out how can we create a better Princeton Seminary. So the day that the people on the ground decide that Princeton Seminary has to be burned down, I'm going to help them. I'm going to go in solidarity with them, which means that I fundamentally relinquish my relationship to the institution. I fundamentally sever my safety net. If this is how I eat, I won't eat. Or I'll find another way to eat. And also, disclaimer, this is not the only way that I
eat. Je pense pas.
Yeah, I don't
juste
imagine.
Que l'université...
Academia is really not the most secure way of making a living. So financially speaking, it's not like it's the sector where there's the most to lose financially at the end of the day.
That's what's so weird when people are always like, academics, elitists. It's like, do you know how much we make? Especially as graduate students. It's like, we're not rich. Like, what are you talking about? But that's neither here nor there. I think the simplest answer to that question is, like, just making sure that you are always visibly a contradiction to the very paradigm, right? And so I mean, as far as extracting the resources, as far as, like, not, you know, being around for social consumerism, I also think that it is important. So this is something that happens to me on Twitter a lot, right? Like, so we'd be on Twitter waging wars or whatever, right? And then people will DM me saying, hey, can I Venmo you? Can I Cash App you? Because you, like, offered so much. I don't take money. I don't eat off the people. And I'm like, if you're going to be in the academic, there has to be an academic, and you have access to the time to research and the time to study and the time to think critically about the ideas that you care about, then that should in some way be freely given to the people that do not sit in your classroom. You already have students that are committed to paying tuition, being in your classroom, go into debt to study with you. I don't think that there needs to be a charge to the general public on social media for the work that we freely give and the ideas, because what we fail to realize is that when we're on Twitter and people are engaging us, it is also helping our projects, right? It's also helping us think critically. And people want to pay because they think that they're paying for your labor. But I do think that and this is different from me saying, like, panels and, you know, and being an academic writer, an essay contributor to an academic journal, they need to pay you. Institutions need to pay you for your labor, period, right? But I have a different relationship, and this is not a universal claim, but unless I put a call out to the people because I need help for something, and that call will be to an organizing community in which I'm committed to, then I am not committed to taking Cash Apps and Venmos for tweets that I have time to think about and interrogate and critically analyze in a way that, you know, I do think other people may not. But that does not mean that other people are not doing theory. And that's the other part of it. It's like, academics do not have a monopoly on theory.
Pape Ndiaye, je le rappelais, vous êtes professeur à Sciences Po, vous êtes historien et votre ministre de tutelle, la ministre de l'Enseignement supérieur, Frédéric Vidal, a dénoncé il y a quelques jours maintenant l'islamo-gauchisme qui gangrènerait selon elle l'université. Elle voudrait faire un état des lieux des recherches qui sont menées en France et notamment celles sur le post-colonialisme. Est-ce que vous vous êtes senti directement visé ?
Non, même si je m'intéresse de très près à ces recherches dites post-coloniales. Qu'est-ce qu'on entend par recherche post-coloniale ? Eh bien, on entend des recherches qui essaient de regarder ce qui, dans la société française contemporaine, est héritier de l'époque coloniale. On regarde des formes de continuité, en quelque sorte, sans préjuger que nous serions entièrement détachés de cette période. Et puis, on s'intéresse aussi à des sources. Par exemple, les historiens s'intéressent à des sources qui sont des sources discrètes. Ce sont les murmures, en quelque sorte, de l'histoire qui proviennent de celles et ceux qui n'ont pas eu la parole, des dominés, en quelque sorte, par opposition aux voix fortes de ceux qui ont produit les archives. Et donc, c'est un courant extrêmement varié, avec des disciplines, avec des approches et avec des débats qui sont très, très vifs.
I think it's really important point to stress. For example, I personally really feel like solidarity is built with people with whom we share a vision. Not necessarily the entire vision, but at least a common political vision. And a shared community. So that's why I decided to do a PhD, because I wanted to buy time, because before I was doing activist work 25, 35, 40 hours a week with everything that goes along with it, attacks in the media, the issue of not being able to find work and ending up with lousy jobs. And then I left France, so I was still doing activist work at the same time, but on the side. So then to go back into the world of academia, that gives me some time. So now I have 4.5 years or 5 years to have the time. And what I'm trying to do is follow the principles of the political project of the main organization, that of Afrofeminism. So that means, for example, that all the papers I'm writing for the university center around that. Everything that I produce can be duplicated in the sense that each paper can be reproduced for a training within a political organization. I continue to do that and to extract, but it's not going to be me that's getting burned out trying to have it all. So I think that's a strategy that people who enter the university should try to adopt, meaning we're not obligated to do this double work, but try to make it so that the work that we do within the university is not in the direction where they try to lead us. Because sometimes they try to lead us to their own subjects, like, now we're going to talk about epistemology, whatever, whatever, which is not the epistemology that I adhere to. They try to bring us toward their own fields of research. But then to put your foot down and say, no, I'm going to stay in this field because this particular field allows me to also produce theory and reflections, which can be useful outside the university for political movements. And that requires resistance.
Yes, I think people often forget that it's a job, right? So it's like, as organizers are being funneled into the nonprofit industrial complex, organizers are also being funneled into the academy, right? And so it is very carceral, as you named earlier. It's very prison. It's giving prison. So it's like there is a prison to organizer pipeline in the different ways that carcerality hijacks knowledge production, right, for the consumption of, for not only the liberal academy, but global capitalism. So I wanted to affirm those sentiments just so that I can say that when it comes down to what we do in the academy, I do think that it is important to understand that, like, it is still your work, right? Whether it is being done in the academy or anywhere else, it's like you're still being authentic to the work that you're producing. You're not lying. I hope you're not lying, right? You're not lying about the shit that you say. And for me, that's important because it's like, to the extent that the academy does not have a monopoly on discourse, neither does the ground, right? And so we're organizing and mobilizing revolutionary conceptions around ideologies. Right, and ideologies that work on behalf of the people that are willing to fight for it. And so I think I just wanted to clarify that to say that, like, I'm not saying that, I understand that being in the academy is a different disposition as far as the class constructs and the time that we have to, like, you know, just live our own lives and produce the work that we do. And it is work that we care about. It is not the same type of labor as, you know, factory workers and fast food workers and things of that nature and unions, but it is work that not only we are underpaid for as graduate students, because I want to make that distinction between graduate students and academics, right?
That's important.
Underpaid for as graduate students.
Très important.
Right. But it is also work that it is also work that is necessary in relationship to how we maintain the sanity to navigate this world, right? Because I mean, I'm not killing myself for the liberation of everybody else. I just wanted to be very clear.
Rebecca, I wanted to know, do you have a book or series or movie that you'd like to recommend?
Books. I don't really like to read. I'm just going to say that now. I'm not a reader and I don't really
Wait, did you mention that in your statement of academic purpose that you don't like to read?
No, I didn't. But I think it's no, it's not obvious because I only read what I have to read in order to prove the points that I want to prove. But I don't read for leisure. That's never been something that I enjoy. And I think that is also a class thing. I'm from the Bronx, New York. I'm from the hood. Not saying niggas in the hood don't read. I'm just saying we got other shit to worry about. So, you know, so I just wanted to name that. But if I'm going to read, I enjoy reading literature more. So I really enjoy reading fiction. Right now I'm getting into Corregidora by Gail Jones, but I'm really scared of the book because everybody has like told me this book is like scary, but yeah. And as far as a TV show, me and my partner have binged so many shows in the last month, but right now we're re-binging Harry Potter. And it's just, you know, I have this like wizard complex right now where I'm like casting spells. Rebecca, je peux
pas. No, sorry, Rebecca, I can't. I've got too many Harry Potter fans in my life.
I am trying to develop a personality of a wizard where I cast spells on anti-blackness.
Wow. I was not ready. So I guess I'll never be able to avoid that. Farah, if you're listening to this episode, I've had enough.
Merci, Rebecca.
Thank you, Rebecca. It was a real pleasure having you with me today. Thanks to Joe, who has done the translation from French to English, for those of you listening in English, and to Patricia, who has done the English to French translation for those listening in French. This was Noir Atlantic, available on all your podcast platforms. You can find me on Instagram at Fania_Noel or Twitter, Fania Makaya. Kizu Studio is a militant and volunteer project. You can support it on kizustudio.org or propose your own podcast ideas. I'll see you next month. Until then, take care of yourself and don't forget to get vaccinated.